We'll read all 12 verses. The transgression of the wicked saith within my heart that there is no fear of God before his eyes. He flattereth himself in his own eyes until his iniquity be found to be hateful. The words of his mouth are iniquity and deceit. He hath left off to be wise and to do good. He deviseth mischief upon his bed. He setteth himself in a way that is not good. He abhorreth not evil. Thy mercy, O Lord, is in the heavens, and thy faithfulness reacheth unto the clouds. Thy righteousness is like the great mountains, thy judgments are a great deep. O Lord, thou preservest man and beast. How excellent is thy loving kindness, O God! Therefore the children of men put their trust under the shadow of thy wings. They shall be abundantly satisfied with the fatness of thy house. Thou shalt make them drink of the river of thy pleasures. For with thee is the fountain of life. In thy light shall we see light. O continue thy loving kindness unto them that know thee, and thy righteousness to the upright in heart. Let not the foot of pride come against me, not let the hand of the wicked remove me. There are the workers of iniquity fallen. They are cast down and shall not be able to rise. Notice the inscription above this psalm in King James Version. It says, to the chief musician. That was the one who was responsible for the use of the song in public worship. But then notice also it is a psalm of David, the servant of the Lord, indicating that the psalm is particularly suitable to those who esteem it an honor to be God's servant. So it is a song of happy service. And you'll notice in verses 1 through 4, David begins the psalm in somewhat of an unusual way. He gives a profound analysis of the sinfulness of sin, of the wickedness of man. And in those first four verses, you see that he speaks of the deceitfulness of sin. He speaks of how sin works in the life of the sinner. He says that sin deceives the sinner and does so in many ways. It so flatters the sinner that he does not fear God. We see that in verse 1. He does not fear God. Sin also so flatters the sinner that he thinks his sin is not so bad. He flattereth himself in his own eyes. He thinks it's okay. So sin blinds the sinner. Sin so flatters the sinner that he's trapped in a downward and destructive cycle. We see in verse 3 that he hath left off to do good. Sin is growing in these lives. He also plans for sin and pursues sin. Verse 4, he deviseth mischief upon his bed. He plans to do evil. You're in bad shape if you get to the point where you plan to do sin. That's pretty serious. He setteth himself in a way that is not good. So he doesn't just inadvertently drift into sin. He deliberately plans it, and he pursues it. Sin so flatters the individual that he does not hate it. He abhorreth not evil. And we could spend a lot of time on these verses, but that's not our point tonight, but you notice David in those first four verses is focusing upon sinful man. But then in verse 5, he abruptly turns his focus and he's praying. Notice in verse 5, "Thy mercy, O Lord." First four verses, he's just talking. He's focused upon the sinfulness, the wickedness of man. But in verse 5, he's now talking to the Lord. His focus has changed. He's speaking to God, and doing so, as you read on, you see that he's delighting in who God is. So he moves from focusing upon the depths of depravity to focusing upon who God is and the blessings of God. And you read verses 5 through 11 and you see that David is addressing the Lord in prayer. Verse 12, by faith he sees the overthrow of the workers of iniquity. So it is a psalm that ends in victory. So he begins focusing upon the depravity of man, the sinfulness of man. And then he shifts, and he's focusing upon God, and he's delighting upon God. And in that, we see two ways to live life, talking about you and I, the saved. We can live our lives in the deceitfulness of sin, as those described in verses 1 through 4. Or we can live our lives in the delight of the Lord. So we want to focus tonight on verses 5 through 11, where David is delighting in the Lord. And that is the subject of the message, a life lived in the delight of God. We have to be careful what we focus upon. I mean, you can't help but see, as you look around, the deceitfulness of sin is all around us. You can't help but see it. You can't help but see the wickedness of man. And those things have to be addressed, of course. You can't just ignore it. But it's not what we're to focus on. I mean, if you focus upon the depravity of man, you're going to find yourself in a bad place before long. Our focus needs to be upon the Lord. So I want to notice the focus here of a servant of God. In verses 5 through 9, you have the words of a man who is delighting in God. What you read in those verses is all about God. It's about what he is and what he does. And what we have here are beautiful statements made about God. But again, David just doesn't make these statements about God. He's talking to God while he's making these statements. And in these statements, we see that there are some beautiful word pictures. But again, it's all in the context of verses 1 through 4. That is, it is set in the contrast of ungodliness. So he paints this picture of ungodliness in verses 1 through 4. And then beginning with verse 5, he begins to paint another picture. He paints a picture of the brightness and the glory and the love and the power of God. Again, in the background is the wickedness of man. And as you read these verses, you see that David is uplifting, he's extolling the person and the character of God. He uses several metaphors. He speaks of the heavens. He speaks of the clouds and the mountains. And he speaks of the great deep. And he does so in an attempt to express the immensity of God. What he's saying in using those metaphors is that God is so great that he cannot really truly comprehend the greatness and the immensity of God. So we have the background is the deceitfulness of sin, the wickedness of man, the depravity of man. And then David prays in verse 5, "Thy mercy, O Lord." Again, "O Lord" is words that express deep emotion. He's praying, and he's praying very emotionally. He's praying with deep feeling. He says, "Thy mercy, O Lord, is in the heavens." Again, this is in the context of the sinfulness, man's sinfulness. As we've said many times, God's mercy is God's, it's His favor that holds back from you and I what we deserve as sinners. His mercy. God's mercy is a wonderful subject. And again, it must be viewed in the light of verses 1 through 4, or the darkness of verses 1 through 4. Because in order to have any understanding of God's mercy, it must always be viewed in the context of sin. There's no understanding of how great His mercy is if we don't have any comprehension of the depths of sin and what we deserve because we are sinners. When we realize how wicked sin is, and we realize what we deserve at the hands of a holy God because of our sin, God's mercy is beautiful. It's a beautiful thing to think that God holds back from us what we deserve as sinners. You know how many acts of God's mercy He bestowed upon us just today? In every day of our life, He holds back from us what we deserve. Just some examples. He prevents us today from getting some deadly disease. Every one of us deserves a deadly disease. He prevents all kinds of tragedies in our lives. And that's all His mercy. And that's why when someone has a bad spirit about a sickness or a tragedy, you don't understand the mercy of God. So in order to have any understanding of God's mercy, it must be viewed in the context of the sinfulness of sin. And that's where David began in verses 1 through 4. So God's mercy flows from the restraining nature of God. God has a restraining nature. That's very obvious. You look around, you see the depravity of man, and yet God causes the sun to rise upon him, feeds him, gives him health. That's the restraining nature of God. And God's mercy, of course, would flow from that. He withholds wrath. He gives mercy. The primary word, Hebrew word translated mercy, it's found 149 times. That is the word mercy. It's also, the same Hebrew word is also translated merciful, kindness, loving kindness, goodness, kindly, favor, and pity. And all of those words really help define God's mercy. The root verb of that Hebrew word means to bow down. So it is It is a condescending to the level of our insignificance. That's God's mercy. It is God coming down to aid and help and comfort us in our insignificance. And we are insignificant. God's mercy is from top to bottom. Flows down from God to us. And this is what the sinner of verses 1 through 4 so desperately needs, is God's mercy. The individual who deviseth mischief upon his bed, that is, he plans to do evil, how he will carry it out, that individual stands in need of the mercy of the Lord. So we must view this in that way. We read in Numbers 14 and verse 18, the Lord is of great mercy. Psalm 103 verse 11, that for as the heaven is high above the earth, so great is His mercy. Those verses tell us that God's mercy is immeasurable. You and I cannot even begin to measure the mercy of God in our own lives, let alone all humankind, all mankind. We read in Psalm 86 and verse 5 that He is plenteous in mercy. That is, He has more than enough mercy. You know, sometimes someone will say, well, if I was God, I would have struck him dead. Well, I'm glad you're not. We ought to be glad that God is not man. He's different. 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 3, we read of abundant mercy. And now in our text here in verse 5, we see that His mercy is viewed in comparison to the heavens. It says, Thy mercy, O Lord, is in the heavens. There's three heavens. There's the first heaven, which is basically where the birds fly. There is the second heaven, which is beyond our comprehension. The second heaven is where the planets and the stars are. Man has not fully discovered the second heaven. Never will. God's mercy goes beyond that. God's mercy goes to the third heaven, which is the very abode of God. So what David is saying is, I cannot even imagine the mercy of the Lord. God's mercy is something worth focusing on. The mercy of God in our own lives, we ought to focus on it. When David says, Thy mercy, O Lord, is in the heavens, what he's saying is it's beyond the imagination. It's beyond human comprehension. The mercy of the Lord, just God's mercy today, is beyond imagination. It's beyond our comprehension. The mercy of the Lord. That's why you have to be careful. You have to be careful becoming too harsh upon individuals. And watch how you pray concerning those individuals, because remember, God's been mighty merciful to you and to me. Then next he mentions in verse 5, and thy faithfulness reacheth into the clouds. You think of the height of the clouds. You think of the fact that the clouds are worldwide. They're everywhere. So is God's faithfulness. Everywhere you go is the faithfulness of God. We read in Lamentations 3:23, which is the basis of a song, Great is thy faithfulness. Great is thy faithfulness. It reaches in the clouds. In other words, it goes beyond our imagination. God's faithfulness speaks of the fact that God is firm. God is steadfast. God is established. He cannot be overthrown. He cannot be shaken. It conveys the idea that in Him is security. It conveys the idea that He is trustworthy. God's faithfulness necessitates His immutability. By immutability, we simply mean that God does not change. If God were to change, again, He would have to change either to the better or to the worse. All change is one way or the other. If He changes to the better, He's not perfect to begin with. And if He changes to the worse, then He's not perfect. In other words, He ceases to be God. Immutability is absolutely necessary to the person of God, to the nature of God. It's absolutely necessary to the faithfulness of God. The faithfulness of God means that God is consistent. It means that God, again, He's consistent, He's unchanging. To be unfaithful, God would have to act contrary to His nature. God never acts contrary to His nature because God cannot deny Himself. In other words, God cannot act contrary to His nature. Because if He were to act contrary to His nature, He would cease to be God. God is faithful. And this is in the context of the sinfulness of sin, the depravity of man. God is faithful. We need to focus upon that. Man will let us down. God is faithful. God is faithful. God is always faithful. He does not act contrary to His nature. And sometimes if you were to examine some prayers, it's really prayers for God to do just that, to act contrary to His nature. You wouldn't want that, because He would cease to be faithful. We see also, notice verse 6, thy righteousness is like the great mountains. So we have His mercy. We have His faithfulness. His righteousness is like the great mountains. The word righteousness comes from a Hebrew word that means straight. His straightness is like the great mountains. What it means is that there is nothing about Him that is broken. There is nothing about Him that is deformed. He is perfect. He is perfect without the slightest taint of sin. That's who He is. That's His nature. Keep in mind, God never acts contrary to His nature. God is perfect. And now the psalmist says, thy righteousness is like the great mountains. That is, His righteousness towers above all. You again, look at it in the context of verses 1 through 4. God's righteousness towers above it all. It's like the mountains. In other words, it's firm. That goes back to part of His faithfulness. God's righteousness is firm. God's righteousness is immovable. God's righteousness, like the mountains, like the great mountains, is awe-inspiring. And like the great mountains, it's beautiful. The righteousness of God. He goes on in verse 6. And he mentions the judgments of God. Thy judgments are a great deep. Probably referring to the seas, the oceans, which are very mysterious, just like space. The righteousness of God speaks of His character. It's who He is. He is perfect. And the judgment of God speaks of His verdicts, His doings. It's what God does. So His character is that He is righteous. He is perfect. He doesn't do anything wrong. He isn't unfair to anyone. He's righteous. But connected with that is his judgments. And righteousness and judgment are connected throughout the scriptures. In Psalm 97 and verse 2, we read, righteousness and judgment are the habitation of his throne. Again, righteousness is who he is. Judgment is what he does. It's his verdict. It's the carrying out of his will. And it's connected to his righteousness. In Psalm 119, verse 137, righteous art thou, O Lord, and upright are thy judgments. In other words, God, you are righteous. It is who you are, and everything you do is right. That's the judgments of God. In Psalm 145 and 17, the Lord is righteous in all his ways. His ways would again refer to, be equivalent to his judgments. And holy in all his works. His works would be the equivalent to his judgments. So he's righteous in all his ways. He's perfect in all his ways. He's holy. He's pure in all his works. So everything that God does is right. Everything that God does stems from his righteousness, stems from his holiness. God does no one wrong. Again, view that in the context of sin. View that in the context of who man is. He deserves the wrath of God. So even when God sends a soul to hell, he does that soul no wrong. He has not done them any wrong. He only gives them what they deserve. Everything God does is right. But let's be honest. We do not understand many times, and we do not know the why of God's doings. We've all, at one point or more than that, in our lives have said, well, why would God do that? Why did God let that happen? Why did God permit that in my life? We don't know. And people will say many times, well, we'll know when we get to heaven. It won't matter then. It won't matter. You've lost sight of what heaven is. But be honest, God's works, God's doings can be mysterious. We just have to come to the realization, I don't have to explain to anybody, and I don't have to have it explained to me, why God does what he does. He's God. We just have to have the faith that whatever he does is right. Whatever he does is right. His doings are mysterious. I mean, we could stand up here and we could talk of many things that God does that's a mystery. Therefore, they're called the great deep. Things you're never going to know. But isn't it comforting to know that he's righteous? So whatever he does is right. Whatever he does is right. Notice verse 6. He speaks of the power of God. He says, O Lord. Again, expressive of deep feeling. Thou preservest man and beast. Thou preservest man and beast. You keep them alive. You sustain them. You think of the mass of humanity. God preserves man. You think of the countless animals. God preserves the animals. You think of the innumerable birds. God preserves the birds. the inconceivable number of fish. God preserves the fish. The infinite number of insects. Thou preservest man and beast. They are all fed by God's hand. They all owe their continuance in life to the unceasing work of God. And oh, the wisdom in preserving man and beast. The abundance of God in preserving man and beast. The power of God in preserving man and beast. This is what David is delighting in. And then he moves on in verse 7, and he says how excellent, this would be in a tone of amazement and wonder, is thy loving kindness. Again, the word excellent means exceptional, magnificent, matchless. And the subject spoken of as excellent is the loving kindness of God. A term that occurs 29 times in the Word of God. And is used 3 times in the plural, the loving kindnesses of God. It is God's love, God's kindness. And in the light of verses 1 through 4, it's amazing. God's love and kindness. God's kindness is rooted in His love, as therefore it's loving kindness. God's love is displayed in His kindness. God's love is as great as Himself. God's kindness is His care, His concern, His warmth, His tenderness. And may I say that God shows loving kindness to all mankind. The fact that God would provide anything for man is an act of God's loving kindness. It is an act of God's mercy. It is an act of God's grace. Loving kindness would include His loving thoughts of you and I. It's amazing when you look at verses 1 through 4, the depravity of man. And man gives very little thought. Man has very little loving thoughts of God. And yet God is filled with loving thoughts of you and I. Even when we're in sin. It's amazing. It's His compassion. It's His sympathy for us. It's His gentleness toward us. It's His generosity toward us. God's been so generous to every one of us. We don't deserve anything. So if He gives us one thing, that's pretty generous. Is there anybody here that's only received one thing from God? Every single one of us have more than that with us right now. It's His helpfulness toward us. It's His friendship toward us. His loving kindness. Now, what is the effect of all this? Well, what we've read thus far, verse 5, verse 6, verse 7, that's God. That's God. That's who He is. We've read who He is. And who God is should be a magnet for you and I. It ought to draw us to Him. It ought to have a life-altering impact upon us. That God has been merciful to me ought to have a life-altering impact upon you and I. Notice verse 7, after making these statements about God, he says, therefore, the children of men put, that's a deliberate act. You put something somewhere, that's deliberate. Put their trust under the shadow of thy wings. What he does here is he draws a picture to illustrate the character of our trust in the Lord. We see the Lord overshadows His people just as a hen protects her brood, as an eagle covers her young. And to trust Him means that we run to Him. We run to Him for shelter, and we feel at rest. So it is a trust that draws near to God. You cannot truthfully say, I'm trusting the Lord, if you're not drawing near to God. Because this trust draws near to God. We read in Psalm 62 in verse 8, trust Him at all times. Trust Him at all times. He's faithful. Is there a time you cannot trust Him? Trust Him at all times, ye people. Pour out your heart before Him. Think of who He is. Pour out your heart to Him. He's a refuge for us, he goes on to say. So focusing upon God, delighting in God, leads to a life of trusting Him. And the character of this trust is it draws us closer to Him. It draws us close to Him. We can pretty much measure our level of trust by our level of closeness to the Lord. Then notice He's our satisfaction, verse 8. They, that would be those who trust Him, shall be, that's a state of being, abundantly, that is, bountifully, overflowing, satisfied. That is, they shall be pleased, they shall be content, they shall be fulfilled. With what? With the fatness. The fatness is simply the provision of thy house. So the one who focuses upon God and delights in God and draws near to Him has a result. That individual is fulfilled. That individual is content with the provision of God. If we are discontent, it shows that we are not trusting God. Because if we trust God, we draw near to God. The nearer we draw to God, the more we delight in God. And we're satisfied. We become very content. We're fulfilled. We don't have to go out to the world looking for fulfillment. We have fulfillment in God. Notice also in verse 8, and thou shalt make them, these are the ones who trust Him now, drink of the river of thy pleasures. So we have the fatness of His house. We have the rivers of His pleasures. And all of this speaks of the joy of the Lord. As we trust Him, and we trust Him as a result of focusing upon Him and delighting in Him, realizing who He is. And the more we do so, the happier we become. Why is it that folks are so miserable? Because they're not trusting God. They can say all they want to, I'm trusting God, but I'm miserable. I don't buy it. I'm trusting the God of all, and that's why I'm so miserable. Trust don't make you miserable. Trust draws you near to God. And there's joy there. Verse 9, for with thee is the fountain of life. It speaks of abundant life. Fountains, as waters of a fountain are continually rising up, ceaselessly flowing. So it is with this life from God. It's abundant life. It's what Jesus spoke of in John chapter 10, the abundant life. It is life lived above the ordinary. And it all begins with focusing upon God. Delighting, and when you focus upon God, you delight in God. And the more you focus and the more you delight, the more you trust. And the more you trust, the closer you draw to God. And the closer you draw to God, the more fulfillment you have. And the more fulfillment you have, the more joy you have. And the more abundantly you live life. It's a cycle. Notice also there's spiritual clarity. Verse 9. In thy light. By the way, that's the place where we can dwell. Shall we see? Shall we see? Light. Oh, we're blind many times. It's because we don't dwell in His light. We dwell upon verses 1 through 4. But in Thy light we shall see light. Yes, we're aware of the sinfulness that's all around us. But as we trust God and draw closer to God, we dwell in His light and we see light. That is, we understand. We understand. So in Him there is light. That light provides guidance. It provides safety. Provides stimulation. So he's praying to God. He's delighting in God. And then in verse 10, continuing in prayer, he says, "Oh, continue thy loving kindness unto them that know thee." Now, God's loving kindness would be a branch of His grace, a branch of His mercy. And the psalmist realizes, I need Your loving kindness. May it continue with me. And Thy righteousness to the upright in heart. Then he realizes the depravity of his own heart and the danger of the sin that's all around him. He says, let not the foot of pride come against me. Now that can be the pride of others. It can be our own pride. Let not the foot of pride come against me. And let not the hand of the wicked remove me. And then he closes with faith and hope. He says, there are the workers of iniquity fallen. They are cast down and shall not be able to rise. He's looking ahead. And he knows, yes, these workers of iniquity described in verses 1 through 4, they're everywhere. But judgment is coming. God is going to be victorious. And he hangs on to that. We must not lose sight of that. So our focus in life is not to be, doesn't mean that we ignore it, but it's not to be our focus. Our focus in life is not to be on the wickedness all around us, but it's to be upon God. Now you just think about it. You have a day, and all you do, you see something on the news or whatever, it doesn't take much, and it gets you focused upon evil, upon wickedness. Does it make you feel good? Does that feel good to focus upon evil? No, it doesn't. It doesn't do us a whole lot of spiritual good. But you hear about evil, and you shift your focus to God. That makes you feel good. There's something there. There's benefit there. Again, we're not to ignore the evil around us. We're not to pretend it's not there. It is there, and it's real. But it's not to be our focus. And because of who God is, there is a wonderful life to be lived. A life of fulfillment. It's a life of trust. Trust in God. Trust, I believe, is something we learn every day. We're continually learning to trust the Lord. And again, it's very easy to say, well, I'm just trusting the Lord. Are you? Are you really? Because that includes drawing closer to Him. So it's a life of trust. It's a life of satisfaction. It's a life of enjoyment. The enjoyment of God. It's sad. I speak of myself. It's sad how little we enjoy God. It's a life of abundance. It's a life of clarity. It's a life of prayer. It's a a life of faith. It's a life of hope. Are we living that life? It's the life that you and I can live. God saved our souls, in which we should be eternally grateful. And we will be in heaven for eternity, thanking God for saving our soul. Saved our souls. But He's also, as a result of that, given us a life to live that the world knows nothing about. What a wonderful life that God has blessed us with. God's people should not look at life as a way as the world does many times. Life is not misery. Not if it's done right. If your life's misery, you're not living right. You're doing it wrong. I mean, it's that simple. But a life that draws you closer to God. Jim led us in the song where we should never grow old. That's a good thought. But unless we die young in this life, we're going to get there in this life. But the key is grow old. We ought to be growing. That's the key. Growing. Some people just become old. They haven't grown old. We need to grow old in the Lord. And we do that by trusting Him. We do that by delighting in Him. What a wonderful blessing to be saved and to be allowed to live life for Him and in Him. Brother Jim, if you'd come and lead us verse song.